Mr. Murray Lee, Reel 6.
And then listening to all this stuff, we had to pretend that we thought it was absolutely marvellous news and hadn't read it, and, you know, Navy's tremendous, and it was too much of a strain, really. And so we always took our social time off with people in the organisation, and that was tremendous fun, because I without being in any way toffee-nosed, all the males and females had really been recruited by word of mouth, certainly up to the time I joined, and most of the girls there were girlfriends of officers, and so we'd all been brought up in the same sort of educational area, and we knew each other and had lots of friends in common, and of course they were very good looking. So it was Marguerite and Joy Lloyd and Ursula Rivers and Audrey something or other, I can't remember what her name was, and Pet Dickey, and oh, there were a whole lot of them, and Francis Knowles. And then, of course, on the male side, we had practically the whole of Slaughter and May, the firm of barristers and solicitors, tremendous number of top echelon Shell people, a lot of top echelon Courtaulds. George Courtauld was with us, a nice man. There were hundreds of them. And then, of course, all the Fannies, who were our drivers, were very nice people too. And yes, one way or another, it was a very happy organisation. As 1942 wore on, we began to run out of girlfriends, and we used to get the most extraordinary girls from the ATS, and they had to speak the language of the country section they were in. They were not allowed to speak English in the French section, and we used to listen to the most extraordinary travesties of Franglais. I remember one girl, I heard her saying to another female friend of hers that, "Ma chère, je ne le toucherai pas même avec un polonais de Bach," all in a sort of Cockney accent. And this translated in, "My dear, I wouldn't touch him with a barge pole." There were all sorts of silly things like, "Il n'est pas mon tasse de thé," "I'm not his cup of tea," and things like that, because they simply didn't know how to speak the language. Well, I think that's about all on social stuff. One of the interesting aspects of the security section was that it ran in two halves. We had John Center, who was a barrister, came over from MI5, and he recruited quite a lot of barristers to work with him. There was the Honourable Tom Roach, and another very nice squadron leader, Hugh Park, who subsequently became a judge and is still alive. He's living in London. And there must have been one or two others. It was Dickie Warden, of course. And these chaps spent most of their time on the legal cases arising out of breaches of security within the organisation. And there were a considerable number. I remember one chap, and stupid man, who was a captain in the Black Watch, thought it was a good idea to send a copy of our daily war diary to the Russian embassy, because he said the Russians were our allies. But I see from my notes on MI11 that even in very early 1941, we were thinking ahead as to what was going to happen after the war, and we were quite sure where our next enemy was going to come from. That was in those days. So when this chap Yurin was found to have passed this information to the Russian embassy, this legal section of SOE dealt with the case, and he got 7 years in the scrubs.
What was his name?
A chap called Yurin, Captain Yurin, U-R-E-N. It was a famous case. And then there was many others like that, but most of these chaps, either failed agents or agents who spoke out of turn, or members of country sections who were considered unreliable and were going to be posted back to their depots. And on one famous occasion, one of my own field security NCOs, who was half Dutch, started talking out of turn. And all these people we used to send up to what we called the cooler, deep in the Highlands in Argyll. This is a wonderful place, a shooting lodge, at least 25 miles across boggy country to the nearest main road, where we had a superb Scotsman called Captain Andrew Fife, who ran this thing. And these chaps simply did 6 months in the Highlands. By the end of 6 months, all their information had gone cool and they were returned to their units.
I think you wanted to pay a tribute to the field security people at Baker Street.
Yes, that's true. They, when I started, there were three field security sections. There was a total of 39 men, officers and other ranks. And they were all multilingual people. They were solicitors, schoolmasters, very intelligent chaps, travel agents, considerable knowledge of the countries of whose languages they spoke. And they'd all joined the intelligence corps without any idea of getting commissions or anything like that. And they were absolutely superb. They went on these 13-week courses absolutely on their own, with no officer to turn back to if they got into trouble, so they had to be absolutely self-reliant. And out of the original 39, I managed to get 36 of them commissions before I went to North Africa. Was it before I went to North Africa? Most of them got commissions by the end of the war. And two of them finished up as majors alongside me. There was this incredible chap, big thick glasses, who started off life as Corporal Norman... what was his name? Norman Mott, who was in the office in Baker Street when I first started doing clerical work, and I got him a commission fairly quickly. And he kept us in stitches because he did the most marvellous imitations of Donald Duck. And when we were being bombed all night and we tempers were rather frayed, he used to keep us sane with these marvellous imitations of this feathered brute. He stayed on for quite a long time after the war. I think he was in Baker Street most of the time, and eventually he features in the footnotes of M.R.D. Foote's book on SOE in France. And then there was another very nice Sergeant Major Baird, who came out to Italy with me, and he finished up as a major. And last time I saw him, he was Director of Education in Surrey County Council at Guildford. We also had the two Ray brothers, Farmer Ray, who was a sergeant major, and his younger brother Harry, who has appeared many, many times on BBC TV. And he's quite an interesting story because, like all the other NCOs, he went round the training courses, but being bilingual in French, he was always on the French section. He was always pestering me to be allowed to go on operations, and you can imagine that these men of mine, they knew every detail of what was happening in the various training schools all over the country. They knew all about the techniques of the finishing schools in Bewley in the New Forest. They knew a considerable number of agents, albeit by the training aliases, but no matter how tight security is, there was no doubt that they knew the real names and a certain amount of the operational details of quite a lot of the people who went into the field. They knew all the techniques, so I would have been failing in my duty if I'd allowed any of these people to go on operations. But Harry Ray went on and on and on, and eventually I had a word with Maurice Buckmaster, who was running the French section, and we agreed that he could become a conducting officer in the French section, and I said on condition that he doesn't go into the field. But the moment I went out to North Africa, Harry Rae was into the southeastern France in no time at all. But I won't weary this tape with the story of all his exploits, which he certainly ought to have written up by now. He became a director of education at York University after the war, and I think now he's a headmaster of a comprehensive school somewhere in London. Marvellous chap. The other chap who went on operations was Sergeant McAllister, and he again managed to get into the field after I'd gone to North Africa. That was a disaster because he was a French-Canadian and spoke the most appalling French, and he had absolutely no chance at all the moment he was caught by the Gestapo, and they broke him down straight away, and he finished up on a meat hook in one of these ghastly concentration camps. I can't remember if it was Sachsenhausen or Mauthausen. It's recorded somewhere in it's recorded in Harry in The White Rabbit by White Rabbit was that marvellous chap Yo Thomas who worked for the Free French.
Now, can we actually go on to how you transferred to North Africa, which I think was in May 1943?
That's right. About the middle to end of 1942, my Colonel Charlie, a nice man, warned me that there were forces at work to have me removed from my job, maybe because I'd been in it for so long, maybe because I was becoming too dictatorial. But anyway, I lasted until about, I suppose it would have been February, when February 43, when the North African mission, which we called Massingham, had got itself established under Douglas Dodds Parker. I believe he and Colin Gubbins, who was running the organization, the paramilitary side then, had gone out to North Africa soon after the landings, and they requisitioned the Club des Pins at about 22 kilometers west of Algiers. This was a rich man's play area in a beautiful bay with bougainvillea-covered villas. But anyway, when February came round, I was suddenly told that Brigadier Gubbins, as he then was, wanted to see me. I marched across to Naudsby House to have this interview, and he said, I want to send you out to North Africa to be Dodds Parker's security man. When are you free to go? I said, well, whenever you say, sir. And he said, well, you've got to take some field security people with you, so you better see John Center and fix that up. I went back to see John Center and told him I'd got my marching orders for North Africa and got to take some security people with me. And this is quite an interesting exercise. We rigged up a room in a flat that we had in Bayswater Road. We bugged it. And all of my NCOs, I think I'd got the war establishment up to 99 by that time from 39, which is no mean effort in the war, but of course with the number of agents expanding as they did from 1941 to 1943, there was a constant stream, a tremendous demand on the security section for these accompanying NCOs. So there were 99 of them, and they were all interviewed, and it was absolutely fascinating to listen to their reactions when they were suddenly told, after doing this extraordinary work here in this country, that there was an opportunity for them to go overseas. And I was surprised. The people I least expected to would say they wanted to go, ones with wives and children and who looked as though butter wouldn't melt in their mouths, were the most keen, and the real tough chaps were the ones who were least keen and put up all sorts of excuses for not going. Mind you, we were only interviewing the French speakers out of the, I think French and Italian speakers, that's right, out of the 99. But anyway, I collected a batch of these chaps, and I think I then had the only parade, the only parade that I've ever attended after I joined the medical corps. All these chaps, none of them had been on a parade for a couple of years, I suppose, and they had to be dressed up in their full marching order, and I thought I'd have an inspection to see what they looked like, because one of the important things about being in the intelligence corps was, although one never went on parade, there was no bullshit or anything like that, we always had to present an immaculate military appearance when we were off duty, and their boots had to be as highly polished as any Grenadier Guardsman's boots when they were walking around the streets in their uniforms. And very often they worked in civilian clothes, but whenever they were in uniform, they had to appear to be efficient, organized, experienced, full sergeants, which most of them were. So, but even so, they were not accustomed to full marching order. I had a most amusing experience carrying this parade. I'd forgotten most of the words of command, but eventually it all went off all right. Well, this was in about February, March 43. Then came the problem of getting out to North Africa. And the idea was that I would go out by air and the men would follow by boat. I can't remember how they got them to North Africa by boat. I suppose it must have been Gibraltar and then to Algiers, because by spring 43, the Western Mediterranean was fairly bomb-proof. Anyway, they set sail in March, I think it was, and I thought, well, I'll be joining them any time now. But there was such a tremendous queue for places on the few aircraft that were going out to Gibraltar that we just sat there biting my fingernails down to the quick, wondering when this was going to happen. I waited from end of February until almost the end of May before Jerry Holdsworth, who was one of our brilliant small boat naval commanders, was also going out to North Africa, and he and I eventually got a passage on a KLM plane. On the first plane out of Southwestern, out of Cornwall, I think they went, after Leslie Howard got shot down, I don't know if you remember this, but the Germans thought that Churchill was on this plane from Lisbon, and it had to go right out into the Atlantic, even though it was an unarmed civilian Dakota. And they went right out into the Atlantic before they came back and landed in Cornwall. And the Germans shot this thing down, and Leslie Howard, the film actor, was on board. Well, as you can imagine, every seat was available in the next plane out to Lisbon, because they thought the Germans were going to have a go at the KLM plane every time it flew. So 30 or 40 of us in civilian clothes with our uniforms in our suitcases got on this plane, and unheated, and it flew at a considerable height, because I remember there was ice on the inside of the plane, and we were absolutely frozen in sort of canvas bucket seats. So it was long before civilian aircraft were in any way comfortable. And we flew at this great height, but there was the most astonishing sight coming into Lisbon on a beautiful sunlit morning, because we flew through the night. And when we landed at Lisbon, the Luftwaffe plane for Berlin was just about to take off. And of course, at this time of the war, both the Portuguese and the Spaniards began to have second thoughts about who was going to win the war. And so we were greeted with open arms by these Portuguese people, and wonderful coffee, I remember. It was pure black coffee, which we hadn't drunk since the beginning of the war in England, and driven in at a tremendous speed by a very wild and erratic driver into the centre of Lisbon, where we were put up in the Avenida Palace, It's rather a nice hotel. And I remember it was just about dusk when we got into the Avenida Palace, and we went out to have dinner. And it was the most extraordinary sensation to be in a city with all the lights on, all the trams working, masses of stuff in the shops, scent, all the things that we hadn't seen for three, 4 years in England. Bananas, oranges, and we'd almost forgotten what these things looked like. Quite extraordinary. And Jerry Holdsworth and I walked round Lisbon afterwards. We went down to the wonderful square in seafront there. And when we were there for such a short time, we had to get up fairly early the next morning, and still in our civilian clothes, we boarded another plane which flew us down to Gibraltar, where we were put up by the governor. I've got a feeling that that very nice man, Major Wetmore, who took me on in SOE, had by that time been posted to Gibraltar. And I certainly remember Bob McGill and Adrian Gallegos were there, but Adrian was on his way with Jerry Holdsworth to form the naval section of Massingham in Algiers. We had a wonderful weekend in Gibraltar. Again, as far as I remember, all the lights on. We went up to see the Barbary apes and, you know, did all the sights. And then by this time, of course, we got back into our uniform, and I was first time wearing desert kit with shorts and those sort of tough calico khaki shirt things that they gave us. Wonderful weather, and it was nice to be in light clothes again. Again, something which we hadn't been able to wear for a long time. None of us had been in the Mediterranean since the beginning of the war. So after this weekend in Gibraltar, we took off in a Dakota and flew to Maison Blanche in Algiers, along the coast from Oran. It was a wonderful sight, looking down onto the Atlas Mountains. We eventually finished up at Maison Blanche at about 2 in the afternoon. And Maison Blanche was a very, very dusty, busy airport full of Americans. And when Jerry and I arrived there, we'd been told we were going to be met with a car. Nobody knew anything about us. And we sat for 3 hours. I think Jerry had already been out to North Africa, and so he at least knew the phone number, and he phoned up Douglas and complained bitterly about the lack of transport. But as we were, the Club des Pins was, 22 or 23 kilometres west of Algiers, and Maison Blanche was about the same distance east of Algiers. It took 3 hours to get a car to us. Eventually we all piled in and arrived at this exotic camp. That's the only way of describing it. Club des Pins was aptly named because you couldn't see it from the road, and there was this, between the road and the sea, there was this very big pine wood, and on the edge of the pine, between the pines and the trees, were a cluster of some 20 or 30 rich men's villas, which had been requisitioned by SOE. I was greeted by Douglas Dodds Parker, whom I afterwards became a very good friend of mine, and his charming G2, John Anstey, who was a director of players in peacetime, cigarette people. And given a room in one of these houses where I rigged up my camp bed, made myself as comfortable as possible. And then, to my astonishment, I suddenly discovered that my NCOs under Sergeant Major Ray, that's Harry's elder brother, we always called him Farmer Ray because he was the living image of a Norman farmer, marvellous, a huge man, bucolic red face and sharp pointed nose and sort of almost a theatrical moustache, wonderful man. But anyway, he suddenly turned up and the whole of my section had arrived there a month before me, and they'd been busily trying to run the security of the camp, which had been guarded by a clutch of Spanish communists that we'd liberated from a concentration camp deep in the heart of Algeria, or Spanish Morocco, I can't remember which. Anyway, we got hold of these people, and they were always known as the Tiny Hands, because whenever they saluted with a clenched fist, and none of them were more than about 5 feet tall, and these were the chaps who were guarding the camp against the predatory habits of the local Arabs.
You mean as regards theft?
Oh, yes, yes. And the local Arabs used to come in, and if you were in a tent and you happened to wake up, my NCOs told me this, and you happened to wake up in the middle of the night, you would see a black hand stealthily removing articles of clothing or anything else that it could find. We had a lot of trouble with them. I don't think these Arabs knew what was happening. They were just keen on pinching anything they could lay their hands on. A lot of them came from what we knew as the Tizi Ouzou country.
That's the name of a particular
Tizi
tribe.
Ouzou is, Tizi Ouzou is a part of Algeria, a section of Algeria. Like Oujda. Because the trouble is I no longer remember how to spell these names. But anyway, this was in towards the end of May 1943, and throughout May, June, July, I spent most of my time liaising with the my opposite numbers in OSS, who were in the same camp with us. Incidentally, this was the first time that SOE and OSS, that's the Wild Bill Donovan's organization, had worked together. And of course, OSS were terribly green in this sabotage activity, and they recruited the most extraordinary agents who had absolutely no chance of survival at all, and they were quite unsuited for most of them for the jobs that they were taken on to do. But then that was one of the big troubles in Italy. The American army put in as governor of Trieste, I think it was, an Italo-American called Politi, P-O-L-I-T-T-I, Politi. And this chap had been a failed grocer in Trieste and had emigrated, like so many Italians, to America. And when the war started, he enlisted in the American army, and because he spoke Italian, he was put in charge of the Allied Control Commission, the American senior officer in Trieste. And of course, all the Italians went dancing around the streets saying, because in the days of shortage, I've run on ahead a bit of time now, but the days of shortage of food, they dancing around the streets singing they wanted more spaghetti and meno politi. Because Polizia knew nothing about administration at all. He was just a failed Italian grocer. However, go back to the Tiny Hands. I was concerned principally with the physical security of this camp, because the bay in which the Club des Pins was situated was one of the traditional spots in which all invasions of North Africa had taken place from Europe, way back to the days of Julius Caesar and Roman times.